Welcome to the Art of Mathematics. I'm Carol Jacoby, and joining us today is Jim Stein, Professor Emeritus of Cal State Long Beach and the author of the book Seduced by Mathematics. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Thanks for inviting me, Carol.
It's a real pleasure. One thing I wanted to talk to you about today is this counterintuitive idea of some even bets that seem to be even bets, but they really aren't. Famous one is the Monty Hall problem that we talked about on the show several months ago. But I'd like you to talk about some that are a little more, maybe not quite as well known. Could you talk about that, Jim?
Yeah, certainly. The Monty Hall problem is easily the best known of this particular genre. And the Monty Hall problem is a classic switcher stay problem. And it looks like, as the Monty Hall problem is originally presented, that it's a 50-50 choice whether or not you should stay with the door you originally picked or switched. But there's a mathematical reason why you should actually switch to the unopened door. And the first problem that I encountered in this area that wasn't the Monty Hall problem is something that's now called Blackwell's bet. But before I describe Blackwell's bet, I'd like to say a little bit about David Blackwell, who's a very inspiring story. David Blackwell was the first Black elected to the National Academy of Sciences. And David Blackwell had plans to become an arithmetic teacher. He was born in a small town in Illinois in about 1920. But it was discovered that he had a lot of mathematical talent, and he went through college and was given a fellowship to the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, where he was promptly forbidden to attend lectures because he was Black. It's pretty frightening. But his talent, as I said, was indisputable, and the University of California at Berkeley interviewed him for a position in the mathematics department. And his application was supported by Jerzy Neyman, who was one of the top statisticians of the era. Unfortunately, he was vetoed because the chair of the department was Griffith Evans, and Griffith Evans's wife was from Texas. And at the time, Texas was a very segregated state, and she said to Griffith, "I know it's the custom of the department to invite new faculty members over to the department chair's house, but I'm not going to allow a Black in my house." And as a result, Blackwell was denied this opportunity to be a member of the Berkeley faculty. But about 10 years later, things changed, and he actually became a member of the Berkeley faculty and had an absolutely brilliant career. And so it just goes to show that things do change, and hopefully they change for the better. But one of the reasons that I'm a big fan of David Blackwell, other than what I consider to be this remarkable story, is Blackwell's bet. And here's what Blackwell's bet starts out with. You have two envelopes, each of which contains a sum of money, and the two sums are different. And obviously, what you'd like to do is you'd like to end up with the envelope that has the most money in it. And you're allowed to open one envelope. So you open one of the envelopes and you count the money in it. And now, just like in the Monty Hall problem, you're offered the choice of whether or not you want to stay with the amount of money in the envelope or switch to the other envelope. And of course, if the amount of money was trivial, like one penny, of course you'd switch. And if the amount of money was ridiculously large, like $1 million, obviously you'd keep it. But let's say it's something like $87.93 or something like that. And it looks as if it's a 50-50 choice. But there's an incredibly ingenious technique for deciding whether or not to switch that will give you a better than 50-50 chance. And it's this, and it comes absolutely out of the blue. When this was first presented to me, my jaw dropped. What Blackwell says is, pick a random number. Doesn't matter how you pick it. Look at the amount of money in your bank account or something like that, and compare it with the amount of money in the envelope that you just opened. And if the random number is greater than that amount, take the money in the other envelope. If it's less than the amount of money in the envelope that you opened, keep the money in that envelope. And the mathematics is fairly simple. You can find it in Seduced by Mathematics. If you Google Blackwell's bet, you'll find it on the internet. And it turns out that this does give you better than a 50-50 chance. To me, this was absolutely amazing. And the first thing that occurred to me, because I had spent some time being interested in sports gambling, is, can you use this to beat the house in sports betting? Because I thought to myself, well, here's what you do. There's a line in football. And so what you do is you look at the line and then you pick a random number. And if it's bigger than the random number, you bet that the home team will beat the line. And if it's smaller, you bet that it won't. Well, it turns out that this technique doesn't work. And there's a very subtle reason that it doesn't work that deals with the actual mathematics involved in Blackwell's bet. And that's that you have to have a chance at looking at the other envelope. In other words, when there are two envelopes presented to you, maybe one's a white envelope, maybe one's a brown envelope, you could pick either one of those envelopes. It's a 50-50 chance. But in trying to beat a football line, you can't see the actual result and bet what the line was. You have to look at the line. So it's like there's only one envelope. You don't have an actual chance to look at the other possible alternative. And it turns out that the idea of choosing a random number is an incredibly interesting way of improving your chances for making a 50-50 choice. And I started thinking about this, and I retired from Cal State Long Beach in 2013 and just sort of fooled around with various mathematical topics for about 2 or 3 years. And then a friend of mine showed me Blackwell's bet, and I've been fascinated by Blackwell's bet ever since. And one of the things that I looked at related to Blackwell's bet is something that I call probabilistic entanglement. And in order to explain the idea of probabilistic entanglement, you sort of have to have an idea of what entanglement means in quantum mechanics. And you don't need to have full courses in quantum mechanics in order to understand it. The basic idea is fairly simple. Two quantum particles are entangled if their physical parameters as a group are determined, but the individual ones are not. And the best example that I can give is the spin of two entangled particles. And if two particles are entangled, one will have spin up and one will have spin down. And you don't even know what spin up and spin down have to be. But the interesting thing about quantum mechanics is when these particles are entangled, neither spin can be measured. As soon as you measure the spin of one of the entangled particles, and let's say you measure it as spin up, the other entangled particle, no matter where it is, it might be on the other side of the universe, the other particle will have spin down. And Albert Einstein called this spooky action at a distance, and he couldn't bring himself to accept it. And it turned out later that an Irish physicist, John Bell, was able to prove that this was actually the way it was. There were no hidden variables that one particle is in contact with the other. It's just the way it is. If we don't know which particle is spin up, which particle is spin down, they're not determined until the moment that you actually make the measurement. So now let me discuss what I call probabilistic entanglement. Suppose that you have two apparently totally unrelated Bernoulli trials. The example that I use in one of my books is the probability that a day in London will be a rainy day. And the other is that a person living in, I live in Redondo Beach, say that a person living in Redondo Beach owns a pet. Each one of these is an example of what are called Bernoulli trials. A Bernoulli trial is a sequence of recurring events such that each event has the same outcome and the probability of any one event doesn't affect the next one. Think of flipping a fair coin or rolling a fair die, something like that. If you roll a fair die and it comes up 3, the probability is 1/6. The probability that the next roll will be 3 is 1/6. The probability that the roll after that will be 1/6, et cetera. These are Bernoulli trials. And for instance, if you take the people in Redondo Beach, I don't know what the probability is that a given person owns a pet, but it's the same probability for everybody. Some people are obviously more likely to own pets than others, but overall, maybe say 30% of the people in Redondo Beach own pets. And if you pick a random person on the street, the probability is going to be 3/10 that they own a pet. So here's the question. Which is greater, the probability that someone living in Redondo Beach owns a pet, or the probability that a day in London will be raining? Now, these are two totally unrelated objects in the same way that you might say that those two particles are unrelated. But even though the two Bernoulli trials are unrelated, the probability of a rainy day in London or the probability of someone in Redondo Beach owning a pet, you can actually decide which probability is larger by something equivalent to Blackwell's bet. What you do is you flip a coin, and you flip a coin. The result of the coin flip determines whether or not you will make an observation of a day in London or go out on the street in Redondo Beach and ask the first person you see whether or not they have a pet. If the coin lands heads, you pick a random day, say June 5th, 1987, and see whether or not it rained in London. If the coin lands tails, you go out and ask the first person you see in Redondo Beach whether or not you own a pet. And whether or not each Bernoulli trial, the outcomes are generally classified as success and failure. For the rainy days in London, it would be a success if the day was rainy, failure if the day wasn't. For Redondo Beach, it would be a success if the person that you interviewed had a pet. It would be a failure if they didn't. So the coin flip tells you which one of the two you do. It entangles rainy days in London and potential pet owners in Redondo Beach. And so let's say the coin flip landed heads, and so you pick a random day in London. And if it rained on that random day in London, you predict that the probability of a rainy day in London will be greater than the probability of a person in Redondo Beach owning a pet. And if the random day that you picked in London, it didn't rain on that day, you pick that the probability of a random person in Redondo Beach owning a pet is greater than the probability of a rainy day in London. And just as the random number in Blackwell's bet entangles the money in the two envelopes and enables you to guess with probability greater than 1/2 which envelope contains the larger amount of money, the act of flipping the coin coupled with the observation of one either random day in London or random person in Redondo Beach, that procedure enables you to decide with probability greater than 1/2 whether the probability of a day in London being rainy is greater than the probability of a random person in Redondo Beach owning a pet. And the amazing thing is that this procedure works for any two possible Bernoulli trials whatsoever. It's fantastic to me that the simple act of flipping a coin entangles two totally unrelated events in such a way that you can make a single observation, just like you did with the Blackwell's bet. What you do is you make a single observation of the money in one envelope, and an apparently 50-50 guess can be improved to something greater than 50-50.
So you could take two unrelated things you know absolutely nothing about and guess which is more likely just by taking only one sample of one of them. And you have a better than 50-50 chance of getting it right. Wow, mathematics is interesting.
Mathematics is by itself very interesting. But what's amazing to me about mathematics is that mathematics sometimes shows up in the most unexpected places. And I've seen this happen over the years. And I remember I'll conclude with just an incident that happened to me when I was doing research. I was in a very abstract area of mathematical research, and I thought that it had no practical value whatsoever, but I actually ended up going to Berkeley for graduate school when David Blackwell was there, although I never ran into him. Like most graduate students, I studied what my thesis advisor was interested in, and he was interested in a branch of mathematics that was very abstract. And so that's where I got my PhD, and I was fascinated by those problems. And I recall writing one paper, and back in the day, what you did was you sent copies to people that you know were interested, and you kept the rest on your shelf, and maybe someone would ask you for them. And so I published the paper in, I think, 1971, and then the papers, the copies gathered dust for about 6 or 7 years. And all of a sudden, in the late 1970s, I was getting demands for the paper from electrical engineers all over the planet. So many that I actually ran out of the copies that I had and had to use up some of the department's Xerox budget copying it and sending it to them. It turned out that what I'd thought of as completely abstract mathematics, having no practical application whatsoever, turned out to be extremely useful in constructing signal processors. Who'd have thought it? And there's one classic example of this that occurred to G.H. Hardy, who was a brilliant English mathematician in the first half of the 20th century. And Hardy wrote a book called The Mathematician's Apology, in which he said, you know, I've spent my life studying mathematical patterns, and to me, this is beauty. And I know that it has no practical value whatsoever, but if you're going to admire an artist for his or her conception of beauty, then don't think badly of me because I'm studying what I consider to be my idea of beauty. And the interesting thing is that Hardy thought that what he was doing had no practical value whatsoever, just like I did. What Hardy did for some of his life is he discovered he was working on problems involving the difficulty of factoring large numbers into prime numbers. And 20 or 30 years after Hardy died, the RSA algorithm was invented. It relies on the difficulty of factoring large numbers that are the product of two primes. And the RSA algorithm is the basis of every computer password that we use these days. It's what keeps your email safe, your bank account safe. Every single individual on the planet is intimately involved with what Hardy thought was totally useless mathematics. Carol, thank you very much for this invitation. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for joining us, Jim. This has been really interesting and mind-blowing in a good way.
We'd love to hear from you. If you have something you'd like to share on the air or a suggestion for a guest for a future show, leave a message at anchor.fm/theartofmathematics. With hyphens, or email me at cjacoby@jacobyconsulting.com. And if you'd like to learn how to get answers from data, check out my class at excelfordecisionmakers.com. See you next month. Thanks for listening.